Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is Jerry Canavan. Jerry, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited. We have been emailing for a while, intermittently, about getting you on, but we finally got it together. So tell the people a little bit about yourself, Jerry.
Sure. I'm an assistant professor of English at Marquette University, and I teach science fiction and write a lot about it, and very commonly wind up writing about Star Trek as basically my primary example a lot of the time.
So do you limit your do you teach all mediums, so novels and movies and TV shows, or do you concentrate on one particular medium?
I usually do a little bit of each. I even do comic books and games and occasionally Broadway musicals. I try to dabble.
You should. I remember way back in the mists of time when I was an undergraduate, I took a science fiction course. I was an English major. And I took one science fiction course. It was the only one that was offered. And I remember nothing from it except the fact that I did not like whatever book by Sherry Tepper we had to read. That's the only thing I remember.
That's what every teacher longs to hear from their student.
Well, I will say, now I don't know about you, but this professor who taught this class was very knowledgeable. She was also, it was clear, she was tenured and she had very little interest in teaching. So it was not the best class I ever took. It was mostly her spending 45 minutes just talking about whatever came into her head, whether or not it was related to the novel that we had read. So it wasn't a great experience. I'm sure your classes are much better.
I hope so.
So I'm going to guess I know the answer to this already, given your academic interests. But would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
Oh, definitely. I watched TOS as a kid. I watched the animated series. I'm one of your listeners who thinks they should be in the randomizer. Oh,
it's not going to happen.
I know. Someday. Maybe do a special.
Maybe.
I watched the premiere of TNG with my dad. 1987 or whatever it was, and then watched, I think, literally every episode with him following, and only really fell off when I went to college at the kind of tail end of DS9 and Voyager.
So what would you, if you had to pick one, what would be your favorite series?
It would definitely be TNG, emotionally. I think you've said this many times that my attachment to that is so complete that it would be hard for me to pick any others. I think I've been persuaded that Deep Space Nine is a better story. It's a kind of more well-developed, complex narrative, but I really, there's something about the characters and situations on TNG that stick with me.
It's no arguing that the characters on TNG, I think, have left a bigger, an indelible mark on me than the characters have on DS9. Although I like the characters on DS9, they're just not as Star Trek-y, if that makes any sense. I don't know what that means, but everybody's in a uniform in TNG. They're all Starfleet officers, so that there's something about that just makes it seem more Star Trek-y, though I do think DS9 is better.
There are characters from, like, Garak, right? I would love any Star Trek series that was just based on him. I think the Doctor may actually be my true favorite character to think about and kind of wish we could go back to him and see what he's doing now. But still, TNG.
TNG is good. And luckily for you, I don't know what has gotten into the random Star Trek generator picker, but it has followed up picking probably the best episode of Star Trek, period, The City on the Edge of Forever, with, I would argue, now I don't know, we should talk about this, but I would argue that this episode we're talking about, The Inner Light, is probably the best episode of TNG. What are your thoughts about best episodes of TNG before we jump into talking about The Inner Light?
I think it would be really hard to pick anything but The Inner Light. I really am fond of Darmok as an episode and think about that one a lot. Best of both worlds, you know, I don't think it holds up quite as well when you don't have the summer to worry about it.
But, the first half of Best of Both Worlds, fantastic. That ending, man.
But this episode is probably the one I've thought most about since it originally aired. Every so often, just the kind of situation that the people find themselves in and their solution to their problem pops in my brain.
Yeah, and I was reading, as I do often, the Memory Alpha entry about the inner light. I've seen this episode so many times that I usually take notes, copious notes, as I'm watching. And this one I was just watching because I had to watch it. And it's enjoyable, but I didn't take any notes because I've seen it so many times. And then I read the Memory Alpha thing, and they talked about how, you know, when they're writing a television show, I think Ronald D. Moore said this, you know, they're just trying to fill an hour. And they wrote this episode, and they didn't really give any thoughts to the implications of what this experience would do to someone, because they were just trying to write an episode, a good episode of television, which they did. But, you know, this is spoilers, people who haven't watched The Inner Light. You should pause this seriously and just go watch The Inner Light, even if you don't normally watch the episode before you listen to Random Trek, which I don't know why you would not, but hey, watch The Inner Light. Not that it's spoilers really spoil too much of it, but if you've never seen it, you should watch it. And so the idea, basically, is in 25 minutes, Captain Picard lives an entire lifetime on an alien planet that looks suspiciously like almost every other TNG alien planet. but a little upgraded, I think. And so, you know, the idea that you could live an entire life in 25 minutes and get all the things that he kind of sacrificed in his life, a family, he has a community, but close friends, all of that, for his career, he kind of sacrificed, but he has it in this alternate life. That would have far ranging impacts, I think, on you as a character. And with the episodic nature of TNG, they don't really go into that too much.
I've always been obsessed with those kinds of weird drops in a TV show like Star Trek or Doctor Who or anything else, where the character has this, what would be an experience that would probably drive a person insane.
True.
And there's just no kind of follow-up whatsoever. The Memory Alpha page does mention a couple attempted follow-ups, and, you know, that flute keeps kind of coming back in background scenes. But, yeah, that was one of the things, having seen this episode so many times and thought about it so many times, that I really got hung up on is thinking about how this would be a catastrophic event for Picard's life that he may never get over. And also the weird way it's kind of cruel for the Catanians to do this to somebody.
Yes.
And stick them with this memory that they can't get rid of. I also, this is jumping ahead slightly, but I became preoccupied on this viewing with how their technology actually works. And I hope we can geek out about what exactly their machine is capable of doing, because it seems to be actually an incredible piece of technology for people who can't solve an irrigation problem.
Yes, I let's talk about that first, because I have, as I said, I've watched this countless times, and I haven't really given it any thought about the technology that it is, because it's a great story. I'll spoiler alert, obviously. I love this episode. It's fantastic. Yeah. But when you think about the fact that the key kind of plot device when he gets into this probe is that their planet is dying. They're having massive drought. What assumes the ozone layer is being depleted because they can't go out without floppy hats and skin protector that Captain Picard creates for his family. I don't know if he shares it with anybody else, but they can't figure it out, and it's unclear to me their level of technology, because I really like the opening where Picard wakes up and there's he gets knocked out by the probe. He wakes up and he's in this different place. And he's like, you know, where is this? He tries to, he asks the holodeck to end the program, all the things you would think normally. Mm-hmm. But then he asks how they send messages to one another, and he finds out about the voice transit conductor, and the doors, like you open them by pressing a button that, like a control panel that opens them and closes, and you close them using the same control panel, which seems very inefficient to me. But then the rest of the, so those seem fairly high tech to me, but then the rest of like the village, is super low tech. It's like, brick buildings, and they can't figure out to get water to their crops. It just seems weird.
Yeah. Well, the thing they've built, this probe, is able to beam this memory or this simulation, however it actually functions, which I also have a ton of questions about, into the mind of any life form it encounters, seemingly, mm-hmm. without knowing anything about their biology or about how their memories are stored or function, with no hiccups. And
well, so we only see this successful probe. It could theoretically, in my head canon, they could have been many spaceships have been ensnared by this trap, because basically it's a trap, and they just killed the captain of every ship that's come by until they get to a compatible being, because these aliens, I forget that, what is the name of the planet that they're on?
It's Catan.
Yeah. Catan?
I played Star Trek Settlers of Catan this weekend at Thanksgiving, so I was very surprised to see that they were on planet Catan.
That's right. There were no sheep that I could
very
see.
Yeah, so I was wondering if it had hit Spock, for instance, right? Would they be a planet that all looked like Vulcans? If it hit a Gorn, would they all look like Gorn? Like what?
That's interesting.
How is it adapting itself to the people that it encounters? And then secondly, you know, is this like a game that Picard is playing where he can make choices, or is it railroading him into decisions and making it seem like they're his own choices? Because that makes a big difference. You know, what if Picard had refused to play along on the Order of Decades, right? He just sits there and refuses to participate.
Right? Yeah,
because if Picard solves if it hit Data and Data solves the problem in 20 minutes and builds them all a spaceship so they can fly away.
That's true. And so they at the end, they say, oh, guess what? This has all been a trick. They don't really call it a trick, but we built this probe to make sure that our civilization wouldn't be forgotten. And the way we decided to do that is to implant these memories into one person.
Right.
Seems very inefficient.
A terrible person. I mean, Picard did not tell anybody their story. I don't think he wrote it down. He kept the flute, but he is not the person to teach everybody the lessons of the Catanian lifestyle.
That is true. He says, I like the flute. everything else I could lose. Let's pause to thank our first sponsor, Casper, the mattress you get from the internet. That's not their slogan, but Casper people, if you like it, feel free to use it. Now you know that Casper is obsessively engineered. It's a mattress that's available at a shockingly fair price. Mattresses can often cost well over $1,500, but Casper mattresses cost $500 for a twin-size mattress, $600 for a twin XL, $750 for a full, $850 for a queen, and $950 for a king. These prices are bananas. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Now, Casper has a whole in-house team of engineers who've spent thousands of hours developing their mattress. Its breathable design helps you regulate your temperature throughout the night. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. So you can try Casper for 100 nights, risk-free, in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. I'm trying to spend two-thirds of my life on my mattress. Now, Casper is made in America. They have free shipping and returns to Canada and the United States. Since you're a friend of the show, you get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/trek and using the offer code TREK. Terms and conditions apply. Thanks, Casper. Yeah, I don't even think he tells when he wakes up on the bridge when they finally, well, the probe shuts itself down. And that's also another, it's a single-use probe. One time, that's it. Because they grab it and put it in the shuttle bay, which makes sense, or the cargo bay, and it has self-terminated itself, but inside of it, it's both a probe and a flute delivery system, because inside of it is a flute for him to play. So yeah, I had the same questions. It seems like throughout the course of Picard's life on Catan, I guess he's there for maybe 60, 70 years, context. They go from, I guess, after 5 years there, because every time they jump, it's interesting what they do, right? They basically cut back and forth between him living this life and the folks on the Enterprise trying to save his life because they think he's under attack. We spend very little time on the Enterprise, but it's interesting because every time they go back, they basically jump us ahead several years in the story on the planet, which I thought was clever. So the first time he's there, he's like, oh, I don't believe this. I'm from the Enterprise. You people are keeping me captive or something's going on. I don't know what. Then we cut back to the Enterprise, and then 5 years have gone by, and he's basically given up the fact that he had this other life, and he thinks it's just a hallucination, a fever dream, because he was sick, and that the life he's living now, which is actually a simulation, is the actual life that he's led, and everything on the starship is something that he's dreamt up, which is an interesting thing to do. But in that 5-year period, he decides we need to build air humidity reclamation probes or something.
Right. He's been doing research this whole time, trying to figure out what's going on with their planet, and mm-hmm. bringing the technology he knows from his other context, seemingly, into the situation.
Yeah, and then so there's one dude who apparently, it's unclear how the government works on this planet as well.
Yeah, I keep getting hung up on this, right? Because there's elements of this that seem like Picard is living every second in this simulation. Mm-hmm. There's other elements that seem like Picard himself might be jumping in time. Like, he doesn't actually live those 5 years. He just kind of gets a general sense of what they were like. When he goes into the courtyard and sees his friend Bataille, right?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like an NPC giving a speech in a video game, right? Where he starts announcing how this, you know, how their system works and everything else. In that scene when 5 years later, when he goes into the courtyard and the administrator's there, Bataille acts like this guy's coming by once a week or once a month, right? But mm-hmm. Picard's never seen him and never interacted with him and seems to have no concept of what this kind of governmental structure is. And as the story goes on, it becomes more and more bizarre what exactly these people, how they run their government. It seems to be a little bit Krypton-y, right? Like, he's Jor-El trying to tell them that the world is doomed.
Mm-hmm. And they're all like, we know, but it's too expensive to fix. Right. And you're like, what? Just fix it. Yeah, it's weird. And the administrator basically says, no, that's too expensive. We're not going to do it. We'd rather die. He doesn't say it like that. And then later on, he has another, like you said, he has another encounter with the administrator. And the administrator's like, okay, don't tell anybody. But you're totally right. We're all doomed, but we can't have panic.
Right.
And they're like, okay, I guess. And this is when Picard finds out that they have been, instead of trying to solve the problem, they're putting all of their effort into building this weird probe to save the knowledge of their civilization, which right. seems quite incomplete, though, because they don't bother to save how their government works, mm-hmm. Which I guess it's not very good, so maybe it's not worth sharing.
Right. And they've cut out whatever elements that the character of Kamen in real life actually participated in this in some way to have his life recorded, right? Presumably.
One would imagine.
And they've cut out all his participation in that part of it. So it's very strange as a project to try to imagine what they did, because the simulation is even able to respond when Data tries to break it in one of the cutscenes, right?
Mm-hmm.
He passes out in the simulation, and the wife is like, go get a doctor, right? Rather than the simulation just crashing or not being able to deal with it, right? It's able to respond to pretty much anything Picard does and anything he says.
It is a very advanced simulation. You would think that it would just pause if the connection is lagging or something, but right. no, it adapts to that. And it is an interesting question that you ask. I don't know if this is like one of those things where Picard has no free will, right? And he is basically just kind of riding in the head of this character as it goes through what has happened.
Right.
Or if the story is changing as he's reacting, because clearly the real character came in, who we assume is an actual person that lived, but that maybe they just created this whole storyline too.
Yeah, it's possible.
Doesn't have the experience of living on the Enterprise and all the knowledge that Captain Picard brings with him. So he's going to make very different choices, one imagines.
Or if it had found a Klingon ship, or I just keep thinking of all the other possibilities, right? Like,
if it found a Klingon ship, the Klingons would just beat everybody up.
Yeah. Even with the flute, right? Like, what if it had found one of those planets of dolphin people that's flying around out there who don't breathe air, can't use the flute? How are they going to incorporate that into the thing? It's an amazing piece of technology. They should have specialized in some other avenues of research, but they could accomplish something impressive.
They did this. I guess maybe that's what we learned from this episode. They're the height of their civilization. The thing that they produced best is this probe that is It is super powerful. And the other thing about the probe is they remark that it's primitive, the Enterprise crew, because it uses...
Oh, yeah. Geordi hates it. Every time they cut to Geordi, he nags on the probe and talks about how bad it is.
He's like, yeah, he's like, this thing is total piece of crap. But what does it do? In like 2 seconds, they raise their shields, and in 2 seconds, it analyzes their shields and knows how to break through them.
Yeah.
Which seems pretty impressive for something that Geordi is poo-pooing. So I don't know if maybe he's just, you know, he's mad that he didn't make this probe himself.
While we're on the subject, I was so amused that they never even bothered to get Troi out of bed for this one, even just one of the few times her power would be useful to know if Captain Picard was in distress or not.
Yeah, but she does not appear.
Yeah, they can't find her.
They give, yeah, so everybody except Troi is there. Dr. Crusher, obviously, she's there to make sure that she basically holds a tricorder over Picard for most of the time and argues not to, quote-unquote, pull the metaphorical dagger out of the wound. Riker,
she knows a lot about stabbing.
She does. Picard has been stabbed through the heart, so, you know, it's important. He's got a fake heart, too, people. Riker is there to say, we've got to do something about this. They're killing the captain. Although there's no evidence that the captain is dying.
Yeah.
Data's there to basically offer up some theories as to what's happening. Geordi's there to say that the probe is crap. Yeah. Worf is there to say we should blow it up.
He's ready to shoot the screen as usual.
Yes. He's like,
his usual response to trouble.
And they try it. Riker agrees with him. And he's like, yes, we should totally blow it up. But let's first just disrupt the beam. They try to do that. And as you said earlier, they disrupt the beam. And that seems to be killing the captain, which is also another kind of nefarious thing about this probe, right? It doesn't ask if you want to participate in this. It just, you come upon it, it locks on, it scans your vessel, breaks your shields, picks someone at random, I assume it's random, because how do they know who the captain is?
The probe even has this power to identify the leading member of the crew.
That's true. They do say that it scanned the whole ship, so maybe somehow it could figure out who's in charge.
And it weirdly, it knows the Federation name for this planet because it's in the database, right? So it read the ship's computer to know that their planet was called Catan.
Well, maybe this is more credence to your theory that it is kind of a handmade artisanal simulation for Picard, and it has scanned his memories, and he knows what although they didn't know where it came from.
Right.
And I find it hard to believe that Captain Picard knows every planet and every system of the Federation.
He does know a lot about archaeology, though.
Oh, that is true. So there are a lot of questions about how this technology works. And I don't want people who refuse my advice to watch this episode before they're listening to this and think that this means that this is a bad episode. No, not at all. It's just an interesting technology and how this could actually work. There's a lot of ramifications about it. And I think an interesting thing that you also brought up is, does Picard actually live the entire time, or is he jumping around as we jump around? Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer to that. I'd like to think he's living the whole thing.
I think the pathos of the episode suggests that he really did have a family. He really did have children he loved. But the fact that they have to railroad him into this relationship of caring about these people cuts against that a little bit. I was also really interested in his memories, right? That this doesn't crowd out his brain, his current memories of Riker and the ship and everything. He still knows how to be captain afterwards, seemingly. He has a couple minutes of disorientation and then he's pretty much back on board. I always get curious about how Star Trek, the Starfleet never seems to pull captains after they have traumatic, terrible experiences. I mean, Picard never should have been allowed back on duty after being taken by the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
Data gets taken over about once a season, right? Like, they never kind of pull anybody off duty. Picard should have been in convalescence for a little bit. I mean, he had a lot to process.
That's true. And he should have been debriefed as well for a long time, one would imagine, because he has the entire... And you would think, as a responsible archaeologist, let alone a Starfleet officer, that he would want to, as soon as possible, share these people's story. Because that's what They have done. Their planet is dead, as we find out when they figure out where the probe came from. And Picard has this knowledge that nobody else in the universe has. And he's just like, did I tell you about this sweet flute I have? Like, oh, you're not even good with the flute.
He got okay.
He did. He's better than I would be. Yeah. I did enjoy the fact that his first, one of the first things he tries to play on the flute is Frère Jacques, because he's French. So, of course, he would play that.
That's a good bit.
Poorly, but he still plays it. It's recognizable. I am not a flautist, but I assume that he is playing it very badly. Like, Patrick Stewart is also miming it poorly, but I could be wrong. Flautists, write in if you want to get angry about the flute work in this episode.
I believed every minute of it.
Well, that's Patrick Stewart is such a good actor that I believed it. And a fun tidbit when his son, so he has two kids, a daughter and a son, and his son, and when he is all grown up, is played by Patrick Stewart's actual son. So that's a fun, and they look eerily alike.
Yeah,
they even balded the same way.
I was so surprised to see that this one it was nominated for an Emmy for makeup, because I didn't think the makeup was actually that great in the episode. Afterwards, I thought it might be in part because we know now that Patrick Stewart is immortal and doesn't age at all.
It is true. He has a portrait of himself in a basement somewhere that is aging rapidly, but he himself is immune to the ravages of time.
Yeah. He looks like he's been on the planet for 300 years by the end of the story. I mean, he's in this kind of comical Gargamel-style makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And the real Patrick Stewart could just jump into that role again tomorrow, seemingly.
It's true. Patrick Stewart is one of these guys who... or one of these people, I should say, who always kind of looked old, but he seems to have just stopped at a certain... Like, he's a good-looking old guy, and he's always looked like a good-looking old guy.
Yeah.
Which is good. I just now look like someone who's aging poorly. So, hooray for Patrick Stewart and his genes, I suppose. I will say, I wonder how much of that makeup looking bad now is because we're watching it in HD, whereas, you know, in SD, it looked great. It was fuzzy, so you couldn't really tell. But I watched it on the Blu-ray, and you could totally tell that they had just shellacked and pasted plastic all over his face.
I was a little sad about that, because I haven't watched them in the HD format very much, and Worf's makeup didn't look as good as I remembered, and a lot of the sets look a little bit fake, plywoody. the actor who's playing the friend, Bataille, on the planet has this very visible tan line on his very low-cut V-neck shirt that I just became obsessed with every time he was on the screen.
Bataille.
I guess they knew that SD TVs couldn't see it, but we're blessed with this ability to understand that this guy loves the beach.
He does, and this actor has been in a bunch of Star Trek stuff, and a bunch of stuff, period. So he was also on Murder, She Wrote, which is another one of my obsessions with life. So,
oh, I remember that episode of the other thing you did.
Exactly. Unjustly Maligned.
Right, exactly.
Or Justly Maligned, I forget. Check it out.
It's random Murder, She Wrote.
Well, Murder, She Wrote is actually a good candidate for randomization, because much like TNG, it is all episodic, so people die all over the place. Nobody ever, you know, Jessica Fletcher seemingly never learns she's always writing her next book. She's probably written like 200 books based on the chronology of Murder, She Wrote. And so it's a fascinating show. And much like, you know, this episode, you know, talking about how you're fascinated by, you know, Captain Picard goes through this traumatic experience, never again to be spoken about. Except that one episode where he has a duet.
To pick up one of his own subordinates, which
exactly.
is questionable.
And he says, I could play this weird flute. Although it is interesting, though, so much of Captain Picard and so much of his character as we watch him is tied up in the fact that he is basically married to his career. He's given up the opportunity to have a family because he wanted to be a captain, one assumes, and other things as well. but he's a career man, no time for family. He sometimes canoodles with Vosh, but that's just, you know, that's not a relationship kind of thing, long-term relationship. There's a little tension with Dr. Crusher, and we find out in the best, what all good things, that they get married in an alternate timeline, but that that doesn't work out, they get divorced.
Patrick, she has some lingering hands on his back in this episode, while she's doing the last scans on him. She's kind of holding onto his neck a little bit.
They've always had that moonlighting kind of tension. Yeah. Although, as I've said many times, he is responsible for her husband's death, so that's complicating the whole thing. Let's take a break to thank our final sponsor, Geek Fuel. Geek Fuel ships out a mystery box for geeks and gamers each month that has at least $50 worth of value for around $15 plus shipping and handling. Every box has an exclusive t-shirt, a full downloadable game, and a total of 5 to 7 geeky items. Now, you will get a free bonus item in your first box worth at least $10 if you sign up using this URL, geekfuel.com/randomtrek. That's right, geekfuel.com/randomtrek. You'll sign up, you'll get a free bonus item that I believe might even be a Star Trek item. So check them out. You get a fun surprise every month for $15. What's not to like? Our thanks to Geek Fuel.
The creator wrote a sequel that you can find in parts online called The Outer Light that's focused on her as the true architect of this nightmarish
program. Oh, interesting.
So there's another kind of sequel of it floating around that I was looking at last night.
Oh, in that sequel, I wonder if her husband like died and she wanted to recreate him.
Some boxes you really probably shouldn't reopen. it's an interesting attempt to sequelize the story and make it mean something different than what it meant in its original.
Yeah, I feel, having not read that, I probably won't go out and read it, because I feel like this episode, despite the fact that we've spent probably half an hour talking about problematic things in it, is such a little gem of an episode. Yeah. It is so good, and just watching it, it reminds me of why I love Star Trek, because it's all character driven, right? It's a light sprinkling of science fiction. Obviously, the plot device of a probe is very science fictiony, but the actual story, if you cut out the Enterprise bits, there's not much science fiction in here at all. You know, they shoot a rocket off, but you know, that's science fact. You can actually shoot a rocket off.
Right.
And if you cut out all the parts, you wouldn't know that there's a probe that can take over someone's mind and project a whole lifetime into it.
Right.
So basically, it's just a story of a guy dealing with, you know, these memories that he's trying to repress, and having this kind of traumatic experience because he had this he fell sick, and then readjusting to life, and starting a family, and trying to save his planet.
Right.
And it's really just a really good story. And then you add in the science fiction kind of, you know, framing, and it just makes it all the better.
I think it's aged really well, in part because we're really interested in these kinds of questions about ecological disaster now and trying to imagine the world without us or what will happen to human civilization and stuff. And there's a real pathos to the moment where he's having so much fun with the grandchild, and then he becomes enraged as soon as the child leaves the room. And he's like, this is, you know, this world is a horror, right? Like we never should bring children into this world that we know is dying. I mean, that's a wonderful moment, especially I have young kids. So for me, this was a very poignant thing.
Yeah. And I mean,
this episode is great as always. He's so good.
Oh, he's fantastic. I love, the first scenes where he's discombobulated because he was just on the bridge, and then he's trying to figure out where he is, and he asks a bunch of questions about, you know, I like his rapid fire, like, do you contact other star systems? Can you travel to other planets? And she's like, do you want some soup?
Yeah.
And he's like, all right.
I like the bit with Batai where he decides he's going to play the game and starts trying to confirm information and figure out how to beat the game that he's now in, and like what is my mission here and stuff like that. It's really interesting to see Picard in this situation, and what he assumes has happened to him, right, which has happened to other members of the crew, that they get locked in either in the holodeck or in some kind of weird simulation, right? It's something like that happened to Riker when he thought he woke up in the future, right? Like those kinds of weird scenarios aren't totally uncommon,
right? He's primed for this kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, and I like Batai. I like their relationship. They're obviously friends, and Bataille is trying to help his friend who is had this sickness and is, you know, he's like, you know, I have to help you through this and come look at the sapling with me and let's chat about things. So I like their relationship. I like the relationship with his wife, his fake wife, and how she's trying to help him. I really like the second segment where, you know, 5 years have elapsed.
Yeah.
And it's obvious that he spent the last 5 years talking to her about his life on the Enterprise and how much he wants to go back there. Right. And he just needs to figure out how to get off this planet.
Right.
And there's
he's building that telescope to try to figure out what planet he's on, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
he is like obsessed with getting off this planet. And then we see the moment where he's like, well... well, she basically says, listen, you spent the last 5 years living in your head telling me about these memories that may or may not be true. I don't know. But we have to live in the now. I want my husband back. I don't want Jean-Luc Picard. And it's really touching. And the moment when you know he's kind of switched from being Jean-Luc Picard into being what is it? Whatever the name, Kamin.
Kamin.
Is when he says, oh, I need your permission to build something. Mm-hmm. And she says, you build stuff all the time without my permission, which I thought was great. Yeah. And then it turns out he wants to build a nursery. And she's like, oh, you want to have a baby? And everybody's happy. And apparently, they can just decide when they're going to have a baby. They don't have to start trying. And so they have a baby. And that's the moment when you think, all right, he's fully convinced that his memories of the Enterprise are the fake memories, and he's actually living his real life here on Catan.
Yeah, and that's a moment where the power of it really depends on the idea that Picard is the one who's making that choice, rather than that this is a movie that he's kind of forced to watch, right?
Right.
But I still, like, what if it was a planet that didn't have genders, right? Or didn't reproduce in that way, or any of these other kinds of things. Like, what other possibilities could Picard have done, right? If he didn't want to play the game properly, right? Or just wanted to, you know, go out in the woods and live there until the simulation was over or something like that. I still wonder, like, what other things could have happened. Would it have turned him off and, like, gone to the next person?
Nope, you are not playing the game right. Yeah. Let's try Counselor Troy.
I think I'd try Riker. He probably would have with a woman 5 minutes after arriving.
He would have,
let's do it.
Yeah, he's like, I'll sleep in the bed with you. Because Captain Picard's like, I've been sick. I can't sleep in the same bed with you. I do wonder about that. I feel like, though... And I think it all goes back to the purpose of this probe. So if this probe is supposed to be, which I think is not true, but this is what they say at the end, like a record of their civilization, then there is a limit to how much they can radically customize this simulation based on who is in it, right? So if it was a Klingon and they all look like Klingons, that wouldn't be an accurate depiction of their civilization, I assume.
Yeah.
Although they all look like humans, so I don't know... If that just means
I started to think about that weird episode with the first race that made everybody else. That's why everybody looks like a human. So there may be maybe they worked on that level of the genetic similarity between all of them. Why everybody can interbreed, and so
they
as
just,
long as they didn't hit a Gorn or something like that, the thing can work.
It would be okay. And so there are a lot of interesting points too. Like I really like in the beginning. So Picard is trying to figure out what's happening. Well, I like the fact that no matter where Captain Picard is, his wardrobe out of uniform is always awful. He's always wearing some kind of silky diaphanous thing. Although I like his belt, so watch out for his belt.
This time it wasn't from his personal wardrobe.
That's true. He can blame the probe for these clothes. although he pulls it off, but they're still weird looking. And then so his wife kind of leans over when she says, let's go to bed, and she's wearing a necklace, and on the necklace is a little charm that is shaped like the probe. And we find out that was the first gift he gave her. And it's like, whoa, mind warp. And that's when he knows, aha, something's up. But then he gives it up. And then the reveal at the end where... You know, everybody's off to watch this rocket launch, and he's a grumpy old man, and he's like, nobody told me about a rocket launch, I'm not going anywhere. And his daughter's like, oh, come on, just go see the rocket. And he's like, okay. And he goes out into the little courtyard, and Batan, who had died, is there and reveals, you know, she says, oh, I guess he says something about, like, it's too sunny, I can't see the rocket. And she says, you've already seen it. And he says, what are you talking about? And then Batan shows up, and his wife, who died, is there. And everybody's like, hey, guess what? Everything you've been through is a lie.
And he's not mad. I mean, that question of consent and the nightmarish nature of this is just so interesting. And I wish, you know, this is what the novels are for, I guess, that somebody should write a novel about Picard's years of therapy to get over his case of what happened to him.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's not all sunshine and happiness, right? Because, you know, yes, he does have a loving relationship, and he has his best friend, and so he has kids, so that's great, and he never thought that he never wanted kids in his life, but he finds out that they, you know, have given meaning to his life, so that's fantastic. But, of course, his best friend dies, and then his wife dies. These are traumatic events, and, oh, by the way, the planet they're on is dying, and there's no way to solve it, so everybody else he cares about is going to die. And he can't do anything to stop it.
Right. And that, I mean, we're getting close to our time limit about not being longer than the episode, but I was really interested in the Prime Directive kind of weird critique that's buried in this, right? Because if the ship had just flown by Catan and scanned it and like, oh, that planet's dying and all those people are going to die, well, our ethics compel us to keep going, right? That's the good answer in a lot of other episodes. But in this case, it seems so tragic that, you know, that they wouldn't have saved these people, or, you know, the other episodes where they don't want to move the asteroid 5 inches over so it doesn't hit the planet, because they have this weird idea of metaphysical idea of species destiny, right, that they can't interfere with. This is a weird kind of counterexample to that, where these people seem like they deserve another chance and they just can't find their way out of this problem in time.
Yeah, because they're spending all their time right making this weird probe. Just maybe took 50% of the staff that's devoted to this probe, and they're trying to figure out how to solve the drought. They'd be better.
Dig underground, make some sunscreen. I mean, whatever you do, try something else.
Yeah, it's not working. But that is a good point. That's true. If the Enterprise had come upon them, they would not have helped them, because they are a pre-warp civilization, and they can't do it. Because I guess the thinking is they might unintended consequences, right? If you save one planet, you have to save them all, and then these guys could turn out to be worse than the Borg or something eventually. So let them die.
or even, I mean, part of it is that the Federation, the humans, don't really trust themselves to help people without exploitation, right?
That's
true. They don't want to restart colonialism and other kinds of things like that.
That's a better explanation. Then they might be Borg later on, so we shouldn't help them. So what were your favorite parts of this episode?
You know, like I said, the whole scenario of this kind of tragic civilization that's dying and seeking to leave a record of itself is a really poignant image that I've loved in other instances of it that I've read. Margaret Atwood has some stuff like that. Ted Chiang has a great story with that theme. So I really like the kind of tragic pathos of them trying to figure out, you know, some way to make their experience not be just a pure nihilistic tragedy that meant nothing. So I find that really powerful. I've been interested recently by rewatching some episodes how often Star Trek crews find just kind of totally ruined desert planets and ruined civilizations. How normal it is for them to kind of just encounter a civilization where everybody died out. And so that is a weird undercurrent in an otherwise optimistic vision of the future. So I got really interested in that again, having seen this episode now for the first time in a good while.
Yeah, and that undertone, I think it's more than an undertone, because it's kind of a motivating force, right? Because the Starfleet and the Federation only exists because humanity went through terrible wars and almost completely wiped itself out. And that is what convinced us that maybe working together is a better idea than fighting and blowing each other up. And that's what the Federation was born out of, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's in the back of everything that they're doing, because this very peaceful kind of exploration-based organization that has banded together lots of planets is based on the fact of the humans being terrified that we will kill each other and everything we encounter if we had moved, you know, slightly differently.
There's never been a better articulation of Gene Roddenberry's dream.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.